So first let me just talk a little bit about why I'm doing business reporting. As the Western Bureau Chief, I do edit some business stories now, but I've been in this job for only about the last 6 months, actually 6 months as of tomorrow. And prior to that, I was an economics editor at NPR. I ran something called the Economic Training Project, where we worked with about 22 stations, well, exactly 22 stations across the U.S. to help improve local economics reporting. This was a CPB grant funded position. It started at the beginning of 2009 and went through the middle of 2010. That's sort of at the worst part of the worst of the economic crisis. We were working with local stations, some in very large places like Boston, New York, San Francisco, and some in very small places like Yellow Springs, Ohio, and Helena, Montana, to bring local stories, to bring this huge national story to the local level. And one of the things that I found in moving from running that project for a year and a half is that during that year and a half, 100% of the stories that I edited were business stories. And since becoming Western Bureau Chief, I would say that that has dropped to 75% of my stories, even though that's not my beat. I'm no longer on the business desk. There's just such a need and want for those stories. In part, every morning on Morning Edition, there's a business segment that has multiple elements, a short super spot, sort of 1 to 2 minute story, plus a 3 to 4 minute enterprise feature, plus all of the other economics news that's going on. In any given, Morning Edition or All Things Considered, you're probably hearing 4 to 6 business stories a day, which is very different from, not that long ago, 10 years ago, when NPR really had 2 business reporters, Jim Zaroli in New York and John Itzde in D.C., and they were really covering Wall Street and the Fed and the Treasury, and that was it. And, over the past dozen years or so, they've really expanded into, a dozen reporters on the business desk in New York, D.C., Detroit, San Francisco, Seattle. They're now trying to cover business all across the country. But even though there are a dozen staffers, we're still always needing more business stories. And I think that actually the business segment of Morning Edition is a good place for people to get started contributing to NPR, which I'll talk about pitching and freelancing for NPR tomorrow. So I always do this little thing when I start talking about business reporting, and I ask some questions here. How many of you did not take economics in college? Okay. That's more than half of the people. Okay, I didn't either. Yet I was a business editor at NPR. How many of you have actually invested in a specific company? Not in a mutual fund, because that's how your retirement is set up, but like you actually like went to, you figured out how to, using a stockbroker, invest company in an actual specific company. Okay, many fewer people. Is that 3, 4 people? Okay. How many of you would say you're good at math? Oh, wow, that's more people than I've invested in. That's unusual. I haven't taken a math class since my sophomore year of high school. So, here's a question that I might get more people to agree to this here than other parts of the country that I go to. How many of you have taken a huge personal financial risk in order to bring something that you believed in to the public? That's a hard way to, you've all taken this financial risk. You've taken that public radio vow of poverty. maybe I should just say, how many of you have taken a huge personal financial risk on an invention of yours that you believed in? Okay, what did you invent? Okay.
What do you mean by invention?
A thing like that you made that you were going to sell.
Thing. What about a company? Like if you started up
a company, okay. Okay. And here's a question. How many of you can honestly say you've balanced your own checkbook in the last year? Okay, I have door prizes for people who so who has never ever balanced their own checkbook? Okay. I stopped subtracting in May of 1995, and I don't know at any given point what the balance is. So, okay, I would like to give a book to somebody who has, who's never, raise your hand again, never balanced your checkbook. Okay, so who,
that's what you mean, balanced.
Well, I mean sort of reconcile. Okay,
I mean, I tried, but it didn't balance.
I mean, just
and I've had zero.
Didn't.
On both.
Yeah. Well, I guess what I mean is didn't even attempt.
Oh no, that's.
I don't actually even know what balancing a checkbook means.
Right,
I think
neither
it did. So who was it? I'm trying to figure out who did it. Who does balance a checkbook, but did it a really long time ago, like more than a year ago, more than a year ago, more than 5 years ago, more than 10 years ago. Okay, someplace between. Oh, more than 10 years ago.
Yeah, like when I was 16.
Okay. Okay.
Just for clarification, you mean like balance the checkbook? You write down all the checks that are outstanding and subtract that balance from what.
And then the second part of balancing your checkbook is when your statement comes in the mail or online, that you actually look and make sure that the statement and the check register where you've been writing everything down are the same.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah, that's called reconciling. That's part of balancing your checkbook. Okay, so I think you've done it, but you did it longer ago than anybody else here. Anybody? More than 10 years that they've actually... Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, more than 10 years ago. You've
long time ago.
Okay. So 15 years ago?
Yeah.
20 years ago. Okay, you might be the winner.
No.
Okay, so well, anybody longer than 15 years ago? Okay, so you get the book Naked Economics, Undressing the Dismal Science. It's a great introduction to how to cover economics. And this is actually the first point of my lecture. I have prizes for each point of my lecture. Which is, I just turned too many pages. The PowerPoint failed on me this morning, so now I have to actually like read this. My best advice is how to start covering economics better is to get a little training. And the best way to do that is to start by reading some books like Naked Economics by Charles Whelan. It's a really user-friendly book. I was scared to death of economics, and they made me an economics editor. So I immediately started calling friends who had covered business. And they said, you've got to read some introductions to economics. But do not go to a college bookstore and buy an introduction to macroeconomics or microeconomics. Go to the general business section of Barnes & Noble and find a book that says, like, the Idiot's Guide to Economics or something. I don't actually like those Idiot's Guides because they're not written as stories. They're just sort of lots of charts and things in unparalleled structure and different font sizes. So I liked this book, Naked Economics, because it's actually a story. It's written by a man. He has a PhD in economics from the University of Chicago, but he, for many, many years, was was a correspondent for The Economist based in Chicago. And we used him at Chicago Public Radio, where I worked before I worked at NPR. And he would come on and just try to explain things that were going on. We used him as a studio buddy, and it might be good for you to actually make a studio buddy in your town, meaning somebody who can come on and talk to you about what's going on in the world of business. So this is actually the second part, finding sources. So getting training, read some books, take a session like this. Finding resources, find some studio buddies. If you listen to Morning Edition with any regularity, you will hear David Wessel on a couple times a week. He was on this morning during the business segment. This was a way to help us have better economics coverage on things that happen overnight because we simply can't always wake up John Itzde at 4 o'clock in the morning to be on the radio. So we installed an ISDN line in David Wessel's home, and now he joins us on Morning Edition with, increasing regularity. He was on this morning during the business segment. Sometimes he's on in other parts of the show. He's actually written a book as well called In Fed We Trust, which is a really good book like Naked Economics that you might want to pick up. Some other resources for training. There's a great website called businessjournalism.com. Run out of Arizona State University, and they offer lots and lots of online training classes. When they smartly and or stupidly made me an economics editor, and I had never edited business reporting before, I immediately found this website and signed up for every single online class they offered, which are all free, by the way. And they're, an hour a day for a week at a time. So, from like 7 to 8 p.m., I was there sitting in my office taking a class on how to read a spreadsheet, how to read a financial report, what the difference between, a quarterly, how to know when the quarterly reports come out versus the annual reports come out, things like that. So I would strongly encourage you, if you're interested in doing business reporting, to go to this website and sign up for their classes, especially the classes on reading financial statements. There are some fairly big companies, especially energy companies based in Alaska, that you should probably learn to read those financial statements. In addition to, you know, reading a good book like Naked Economics and taking some classes at businessjournalism.com and making a studio buddy, that you wouldn't have to necessarily put on the air all the time, but could be the person in your town or the person in your state that you can call up and talk to. I would say the most important actual concept, this is the part where I'm going to actually impart an economics concept on you. The others I'm just going to say read around in these other books. Is there anybody here who can tell me what the risk-return ratio is? The risk-return ratio. It's usually risk/return ratio.
Is that like ROI?
No, that's return on investment. That means, you know, how much are you getting back from what you put in? But there's something. There's a concept. Whenever you're covering a business, you know, the press release will come out and say something like, you know, with almost no seed money, they, you know, made $1 billion. Well, that is in fact almost an impossibility. And so the risk return ratio is this concept that whenever you're covering a business, just be mindful of the fact that this is almost always true. And if they tell you otherwise, they're lying to you probably. Which is that the greater the risk you take on, the greater risk you take in a business affords you the possibility of a greater return. So the greater amount of money you invest affords you an even greater return. So, you know, if something like, if people had actually paid attention to the risk-return ratio concept in the whole Madoff scandal, people would have realized that, like, I'm getting way too much money for taking far too little risk. And people want to believe that economics concepts are not true, but they are true. They're actually, it's called the dismal science for a reason. And it's that they are almost always true, and that there are very few exceptions to those rules. And if you think you're the exception, you're not the exception, you're just foolish. The other issue of training that I would say is, and I think there's actually a session on this, learning to use spreadsheets. There's a session on this later. Okay. You should, I think though that it's like against my session in the schedule, so I don't want to do this to myself, but I would strongly encourage you to take the session on how to use a spreadsheet.
It's at the same time as one of the coaching sessions.
Oh, okay. So only the person who's being coached by me won't be able to go to that session. So if you know how to use Excel and Access, or Excel, don't go to that. I guess come to my session. I want to talk a little bit about sourcing stories. I've been listening a lot in preparation for coming here. I listened to those of you who archive on your sites a lot of your stories, and I would say that here's the thing that I found. That you do a lot of information. All of your stories are very, very, very full of information, but I can't remember a single one that I heard because they're too full of information. And the problem is there isn't enough story in them. So I'm going to read for you a sentence that I heard on the radio recently, and I want you to tell me what it means. It has a lot of information in it. The U.S. Agriculture Department estimates farmers nationwide will ship more than 35 million trees this season, up from the previous high of 34.3 million trees sold in 1988. The volume has increased by as much as 2.5% annually for the past 15 years, at least twice the growth rate of the U.S. population. Farmers are receiving $7 to $11 from wholesale buyers for each top-grade Douglas fir 6 to 7 feet tall, compared with $8 to $11 last year. The price varies by quality and quantity, and some smaller growers lacking a strong relationship with a buyer are getting $1 less this season. What does that mean? I heard this on the radio, and I had to listen to it 5 times to transcribe that. This was not one of you, by the way. This was.
Thanks, Jay.
Okay, there is a lot of information. There is absolutely no story. in that information. I have heard, I've now listened to three different stations. I have heard this weather forecast, or this sunrise forecast, which I'm sure is very important, but I don't know what it means, that the sun rose today at 7:33:35 a.m. and was up for 13 hours and 14 minutes. It sets tonight at this time. That's 6 minutes more than the night before. I really honestly don't know why I'm hearing that. Why is that important? Right. But can't you just say there's six more minutes of daylight today?
People want to know when the sun's coming up, is it fishing or other?
Okay.
Old people need to know when to go out.
Oh, no, don't say the loss, only say the gain. Okay. Okay, maybe it's like the, and on the BBC they have this really fun thing called the shipping forecast. No, it's like a litany. It's like off bright spit seas at 5 feet. And like, because they have these names, these very funny, engaging names for parts of the ocean around the British Isles. And so you hear these great names like bright spit and, you know, warm spit and these, you know, various names. So maybe it's like that. Maybe
you would hear that in any small station around the state. Yeah. Marine forecast.
Yeah. Marine forecast. Yeah. Okay.
But our
okay.
Names
so
aren't as funny as the British.
Right.
Are you
well,
going to keep suckling to Gore Point.
So, okay. So perhaps if you rename, if you had funny names to engage, listen. I understand. This is a local issue that's probably more important here than in other places. When I lived in Minnesota, I used to just say, it's very cold outside on the radio. I would not try to give, if it's six, the difference between 40 below zero and 45 below zero is not that different to people walking around in Minnesota. The example that I gave there of the fir trees, this was actually a story about decorating Christmas trees. And about the economics of buying and selling Christmas trees, which had not a single person who was actually buying a Christmas tree. Now that I've told you this is a story about Christmas trees, who might you actually talk to if you're doing a story about buying, about the price of Christmas trees? Do you, somebody selling a Christmas tree, just is business better than last year, getting more money for your trees? And somebody buying a Christmas tree, which is going to have a great scene in it.
The perfect opportunity to get child's voice.
Right, right. Right, and not in a sort of a, like, terrible things happening to children way that is almost always how we have children on the radio. Or, like, you know, terrible, terrible school system, terrible clergy sex abuse, terrible this, that, or the other thing. But this is actually a nice way to get kids into a story. There weren't any kids in this story. There was, I've read this so many times and I've listened to it so many times. I honestly don't know what it's trying to tell me. I think that the price of trees has dropped. People are paying a little less for trees, and people are making less money on the trees they sell. I think that's how I would summarize that, and that's what I would do as an editor. I would say, do not give me all of those numbers.
Was that a piece of AP?
No, it was on the radio. I mean, it was in an actually reported story, and I still
it's
honestly
numbed by the numbers.
Yeah.
Because I lost track after the first sentence.
Right. So I would say that this piece of advice that I give for writing business stories is, decide what the two numbers are going to be in the story and make sure that they're related to each other. Last year, trees were going for $11 a foot. This year, trees are going for $10 a foot. Those are two numbers, and they're comparable to each other. I can, you're not asking people to do complicated math there. They can tell. Or you could say, last year, trees were going for $11. They're going for a dollar less foot this year. Don't confuse people with how tall the trees are, because you don't really need to know how tall the trees are. I mean, maybe if you are in the lumber or the timber industry, then you need to know. But I think there are better ways to get that information if you're in the timber industry than listening to Morning Edition. Did you have a question? I tend to say that there need to be as few numbers as possible, likely just two numbers, and they need to be related to each other. Like, you know, college used to cost $10,000 a year. Now it costs $12,000 a year. Like a number like that. Don't make people do math. Like, college used to cost $10,000 a year, and over the last 6 years, it's increased 6% per year. Okay, who's really good at math here? And then are we compounding that 6%, or is it 6% based on the 10,000? You know, you're asking people, you're going to cause traffic accidents if you make people do math. So I strongly encourage people to not do math, not to ask people to do math on the radio. Let me talk a little bit more about sourcing stories. Rather than talk to six experts for a story, I think the best way to actually source a story, let's use the tree example, is to actually go to somebody who's doing the thing. Rather than to talk to the industry analyst about trees, actually talk to a person who grows trees, who's going to bring you a real person that one of your listeners can actually relate to, because most of your listeners are not industry analysts, because they're far too busy analyzing their industries to be listening to Morning Edition. Real people listen to Morning Edition, and we want to be able to connect to those people. So you can empathize with somebody who can't afford to buy a Christmas tree because it's too expensive, or that this year, for the first year in 3 years, they can afford to buy a Christmas tree because the Christmas trees are now, you know, 20% less than they were last year. So your primary sources, I think, should be the real people actually affected by the larger story that you're trying to tell. And I always like to have my reporters start with those people. I want to play a piece for you now. That this is a 3-minute and 15-second piece that was on Morning Edition, and he did all of the reporting in one day. So he went out, did all the interviews in one day, wrote it that afternoon, we edited the next morning. It aired the following morning on All Things Considered. But this is about 6 to 8 hours of reporting. Listen, tell me who's in, you might want to take notes, just tell me who's in the story. Who are the experts in this story?
There was no recession at the Dry Dock Brewing Company. This beer maker in Aurora, Colorado was the next place we visited in our series on small businesses. Reporter Kirk Siegler from member station KUNC has the story of a brewer that's expanding thanks to loyal customers, a tasty product, and a bit of help from the federal stimulus bill.
For Kevin DeLang, the fermenter is where it all comes together. His extra special bitter ale, and lately, his profits.
And then it will spend the next 2 weeks in the fermenter, and that's when the yeast really works its magic. It eats that sugar, turns it into alcohol and carbon dioxide.
And then beer, which DeLang can make a lot more of now that he's bought a sixth fermenter at his modest brewery. Dry Dock is tucked away in a strip mall in the Denver suburb of Aurora. DeLang beams as he stands next to the shiny silver 15-foot-high tank.
The primary bottleneck is the number of tanks that you have to actually ferment the beer. So you can only make as much beer as you have room to put it to ferment at one time.
DeLang expanded his successful brewery into this new, bigger space this past summer. The federal stimulus bill helped him get a waiver on the closing costs of his Small Business Administration loan. All he had to do was promise to reinvest the money in his business, and the $20,000 he saved just happened to be the cost of a new fermenter.
That single fermenter probably created a half a job.
But DeLang says it's creating ripple effects across his business. He hired that halftime brewer because there's more beer to be made.
And then more customers come in, we need more bartenders, we've gotten so busy that now I need a full-time bar manager to handle that.
And possibly a new bookkeeper so that DeLang can concentrate on strategy and marketing. All this is quite a milestone for a business that has just 7 full-time staffers. One of those is head brewer Bill I. He was hired on this summer. I was lucky to score the gig. Earlier this year, he was laid off from a larger chain brewery nearby.
It's not like I'm an IT guy and there's so many firms out there. There's a limited number of breweries in the city, and when I was looking for a job, I talked to everybody. And when I say everybody, we're talking 15 places, 10 places. I mean, there's just not that many breweries.
But I still figures the so-called craft brewing industry is fairly recession-proof. And if Dry Dock is any indication, beer drinkers are staying loyal even in tough times. Take regular Tobin Anderson. He's sipping an India Pale Ale in the brewery's spacious new bar during a busy happy hour. At 6.4% alcohol by volume, he says an IPA goes a lot further than a domestic, like Coors or Bud.
I mean, you get more bang for your buck.
I love that detail.
And Anderson says he doesn't mind paying the premium, $4 a pint.
You know, it's excellent beer. You know, you pay a little more, but it's worth it to me, plain and simple.
Down the wood-paneled bar, owner Kevin DeLang is pouring a sample of Bismarck Alt, which won a gold medal at the Great American Beer Festival this fall.
The Alt beer's a German style. It's amber in color, really clear. There's a little bit of hop bitterness in the finish.
Dry Dock also won Small Brewery of the Year at that festival. DeLang thinks that was due to the brewery's impressive four-year run. Sales have grown by at least 30% each year.
Cheers.
Cheers.
DeLang is already looking at expanding again, possibly into a warehouse space, so we can start bottling and shipping beer around Colorado. For NPR News, I'm Kirk Sigler in Denver.
Today we continue our series.
Stop. So let me tell you what the assignment was for this story. In a business desk meeting, we said, we need to cover the stimulus somehow. And somebody in Washington said, well, why don't we just talk about like the average size of stimulus money that small businesses are getting. We could talk to somebody from the Treasury Department. We could talk to somebody from, you know, the Small Business Administration. We could talk to somebody. We might be able to find somebody who runs a business who got one of these grants. Well, do you want to hear somebody from the Small Business Administration talking on the radio? No. So what was this story about?
It's about a person. Right. You put a face on what's happening to the everyman who's got a little business.
Right. And so this was the story, you know, what's happening with federal stimulus dollars. But instead of talking to official talking heads, we said, I said to Kirk, I do not want any experts in this story, because you know what? The guy who runs a small business is an expert. He runs this small business. So who's in the story? The owner of the small business, a customer who's willing to pay more, one of the employees. These are all experts in their fields. He's an expert at being an employee. He knows what it's like to not be able to get a job and then be able to get a job. He knows what it's like to be laid off. And you could talk to an economist about what it's like to be laid off, but economists all seem to have jobs right now. people who run fermenters, brewmasters, don't necessarily all seem to have jobs right now.
Was there a discussion in your meeting when you decided on this over, well, do we need in this story somebody who is going to say, well, you know, it hasn't helped me, or, you know, like somebody, you know,
what we want to do is, how is it helping small businesses?
Right.
We did other stories about
in
not
series.
Helping.
Yeah.
Yeah, this was a series on small businesses.
So I have the same question, like, this is a great story indicating how stimulus can work to help a small business, but where was the failsafe to make sure that this particular story was indicative of the policy working?
Not every story is comprehensive. You're not writing 40,000 word New Yorker pieces. So
sometimes there's something in the background the audience doesn't hear, mm-hmm. or the reader doesn't see, to make sure that it's
This was part of a series that aired every Tuesday for 2 months in the business segment, mm-hmm. on small businesses and how they were being affected by the recession. And this was the success story. We did some others this was like how a small business made good using stimulus money. That was the idea behind this one. I'll play another one for you in a minute, which was a small business that started during the recession without any help from the government and how they were doing.
I guess for me with that story, there was no, like, I heard stimulus at the beginning, but at the end, all I was thinking was beer. And I forgot it was about the stimulus until you said it again. Oh, yeah, stimulus. There was, like, no takeaway. It was, like, I never thought I'd say this, but there was, like, too much story.
Yeah, it came in the middle, though. He talked about the 20,000 and how it rippled out. He talked about the 20,000 and how it kind of rippled out to the new fermenter and the new employees.
More customers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess there was just no takeaway. At the end, it didn't, like, come back full circle.
I think she's got a point that I kind of was just wondering is that you do have, it was very interesting to listen to, but for most of the story I was hearing beer, except for the middle one, the rippling out of the effects of the stimulus, but I can't, it came with a takeaway of mainly more about this interesting little company in Denver.
More like a profile,
and I was kind of thinking, God, that guy must have loved this story. Just like, you know, which is fine, you know, but it's a great little small example, but I almost wanted to hear it more in the context of the series, mm-hmm. you know?
I mean, I would say, I agree that a series sort of, not every 3.5 minute story can contain the world.
Yeah.
I actually think that the takeaway for this story is the stimulus helped somebody. There was a lot of talk at this time, when this aired last summer, or the summer before last, that, you know, where was all this money going? Was it doing anything? And I mean, I think that's the point of the story. And this is actually something that I said to Kurt, like, what's the point of your story? Now you've done all these interviews. You need to know what the point of the story is, and that point needs to be referred to throughout the story. Like, this company got stimulus money. This is how the stimulus money actually helped people. You know, beer is the hook for people because people are going to listen to a story about beer much more likely than they're going to listen to a story where you talk to three economists. I guess I don't actually think that the story gets in the way of the information, but I
guess it just didn't come back, like, at the end. Mm-hmm. It ended on a beer note, not on
right.
a stimulus note.
Yeah.
Which is fine.
I think the point that he ends on is that he's actually thinking of having to expand to an even larger space, which, I mean, that sort of indicates to me that, oh, this actually went beyond just this one. They're actually going to grow even larger. This one $20,000 didn't just do this one half-time job. It actually will continue to have ripple effects.
I guess I'm just thinking, like, from an average listener, which I am, because I can be, like, plants, you know, and I'm listening or driving, you know, you don't, like, we're all smart and we're listening to the story because mm-hmm. we're listening to it, but most people are driving
mm-hmm.
or working or not fully listening, and that's why I think, like, at the end, you really have to come back to it, like, plainly state it, mm-hmm. otherwise, all those things that you're saying are in the story are totally in the mm-hmm. story, I'm not arguing
that. Right, right.
They just, you know, they get lost in the drive.
But I think, at least to me, I mean, this is one story, but this
right.
is this ran in morning edition,
yeah.
Or,
yeah.
you know, which is, you know, a couple hours a day, which has probably been packed with tons of information about stimulus money and
yeah.
congressional debate and all those people who you didn't put in this story.
Right.
So this was a way to say, hey, what's it mean to person X?
Yeah.
So I think, I mean, the larger context is there.
I mean, I'm not arguing it's
yeah.
bad or, like, it's not bad. I just... The end of the story, I wasn't thinking stimulus at all.
Oh.
But how people listen. I mean, I'm not arguing. I'm
no,
just saying
yeah.
different people. I personally
mm-hmm.
got the point.
See, actually, this is what makes me strange as a journalist. Like, I am very disinterested in information. I do not want to know. Like, I couldn't tell you, like, how much money was in the federal stimulus bill, but I'm very interested in stories about, like, what that money did. I don't understand $1 trillion, but I do understand $20,000. And so, like, there was a lot of thinking, like, how can we help a listener understand what this very large package means to small people? But, and I think there are multiple entry points into the story. Maybe you're a small business owner, and you understand the story at that level. Maybe you are the bartender, and you enter the story through that character. When I talk about people in stories, I talk about them as characters because there is somebody. I try to get as many people in a story as possible that some listener might be able to relate to. And if you're not a small business owner, but you just like beer, that's your entry point for the story. Oh, that brew pub that I really like, it's not going to go out of business. In fact, it's expanding. And look, that other brew pub that I like went out of business. So maybe that's your only entry point for this story. And I think that needs to be enough. I think that we can't be in charge of people's responses to stories. We can do a lot, but we can't tell them exactly what to think.
I had a question more on different, but when you're dealing with a story like this, I think in small towns, and folks may have found this as well, when you want to talk to a business owner, sometimes the only way you can get them to talk to you about stuff is if you don't push them for numbers and
mm-hmm.
for the details of things, but they might talk about how their business has improved, and that might lend itself to the stories you're talking about. Is that, like, so that when you're talking with someone about how, okay, they've improved, they might say, you know, we've built an addition onto our business.
Mm-hmm.
But so do you feel like you need to try and get them to say to tell you the details or, you know,
I insist that my reporters ask those difficult questions, like, how much money did you invest?
Even if it's not in the story.
Yeah, it may not be in the story. You know, but if I had somebody doing a story recently about being foreclosed on, and I said, you need to look at their mortgage, and you need to see what their mortgage payment was. And if they won't cooperate with you, then we're not putting them on the radio. For this story, you know, he cooperated because he knew this was a great ad. And I think that it's fine as a reporter to say, look, what you get out of this is a national story about your brew pub, but I need to get something out of this too. And part of that is that I'm a journalist and I need to make sure that what I'm saying is actually true. So Kirk actually saw the stimulus check. It's not in the story because it's kind of like, and I looked at a stimulus check. How would you know, do that in the story? But that's part of the fact checking of doing reporting. You know, and so I had him actually, you know, I said, you know, look at you know, ask the bartender, is he making more money now, or is he getting more work? You know, he expanded from 6 people to 7 people, or, you know, what are those numbers? Now, you need to know them. You don't need to put them in the store.
Is it okay? Do you think it's okay then to say to your source, I'm not going to put this in the story, but I need to see your mortgage in order to feel,
I mean,
like,
you know, I think we all have conversations with sources where you negotiate what you're going to say or not say.
So you think that's okay? I mean, that's what,
yeah.
Yeah,
I mean,
okay.
I think we have this discussion a lot. You'll hear sometimes on, you know, it's like Mara Liasson will say, you know, a high-level White House source says. Mara knows that person's name, and her editor knows that person's name, too. And it's that we have decided to withhold that person's name because, you know, that person would lose their job if we said this is who said it. But, you know, I sometimes will be editing a story, and a reporter will say, you know, Jill didn't want to give her last name. And I said, well, do you have Jill's last name and phone number? No. Well, then we can't put her in the story. Like, anonymity is an arrangement between the reporter and the source that is not about them being anonymous to you as a reporter. It's about them being anonymous to the audience. But it's part of your due diligence as a reporter to, you know who they are and how to reach them again. Because maybe they lie to you, and then you need to be able to find them again and say, you lied to me.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, when you're looking at stories and trying to pare it down to ideally two mm-hmm. numbers, if there's some numbers like the tank is 15 feet high, mm-hmm. they're sort of pedestrian and descriptive that you're not
right.
Preoccupied with.
Yeah, I think it's putting two numbers too close to each other. And if you're, you know, I think 15 feet high is not near other numbers. The 20,000 is not near other numbers. The only reason I let him get away with saying what the alcohol level was is that I thought it was a funny piece of tape because he's willing to pay more because he can get drunker faster. And I just thought, like, that was such a delightful moment in the story. And for some people, that might be the only thing they remember about the story. It tends to, like, I always forget that he got a $20,000 stimulus loan, but I remember that, like, this person was willing to pay $4 for a pint of beer because it had a higher alcohol content. He was engaging in a certain kind of stimulus or lack of stimulus.
Or depressants.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess a depressant. Yes.
But just one more point, mm-hmm. and I have to skew this forth. Why would you prefer to listen to the Christmas tree story
right.
or the beer story?
Right.
Beer story wins, you know?
Right. I want to play another from our small business series for you. I loved this series because... let me tell you, most of the reporters who, not Kurt, files for us all the time, but most of the 7 or 8 pieces that were in the series were done by first-time reporters for NPR, people who had never filed for us before. And this is one of those people. This was her first piece for NPR. And this, I think, now, you will hear what doing a piece for NPR can, how the resources are made available to you to do some pretty amazing things when you're actually working on a national piece for NPR. Because there's this moment when we start in Helena, Montana, and then we're suddenly in Wilmington, Delaware, and it's a little unclear. Well, we hired somebody to do a tape sync for her to interview the person in Wilmington, Delaware, who also got a scene for her in Wilmington, Delaware. The listener, you know, may have thought that she traveled herself to Wilmington, Delaware, because you hear a scene in Helena, Montana, and a scene in Wilmington, Delaware. And, you know, when you do National Pieces First, we pay for all of that. So this was another piece in the Small Business Series.
It's setting out about
Oops.
Young people out
Oops.
Of college. And look,
there.
New business ventures start every day, recession or not. And just as the economy was sinking last year, two former college football players launched a women's fitness program. This is our latest look on small business. And Montana Public Radio's Emily Ritter has the story.
Twice a week, a group of women meet at Smitty's Barn, just outside the small town of Anaconda, Montana. You walk through a gravelly parking lot and up a few stairs to the wooden porch outside Smitty's. You can hear music and cheering, and about 10 women, ranging from their mid-20s to mid-50s, are boxing. This is Pink Gloves Boxing. Erin Nicholas is a petite woman dressed in a pink t-shirt and sweats. She's working one-on-one with a trainer.
feels very empowering. I'm here because I had a baby and I needed to get back into shape, and I needed something that would also provide a little bit of social interaction as well as a really great workout, and this did that for me.
There's no contact, no ring, no real competition in fact, just a fitness group that was started by a recent Carroll College grad, Garrett Garrels.
She thought, oh, this is great, let me invite my friend next time. Next time she invites her friend. Now there's two of us, then one invites another friend. Next thing you know, there's 10 of us meeting on Saturday mornings in the park.
3 years ago, Garrels opened a personal training business, and he began teaching his clients the basics of boxing. Garrels recruited his old football teammate, Nick Milodragovich, as a business partner. In college, Garrels studied exercise science and Milodragovich engineering. Milodragovich says they wanted to create a women's-only fitness program that was a community.
When they're with the trainer, that's when they put on the gloves, the trainer has the mitts, they go through combinations, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, uppercut combination, all this good stuff. It's an emotional release, it's a physical release.
1, 2, 3, 4. What started as a little group at Smitty's Barn in Anaconda is growing. The guys now have a licensed product and are selling Pink Gloves Boxing to health clubs across the country.
What we're seeing is a lot of excitement and also a lot of hesitation to commit the money.
Gyms buy Pink Gloves for an initial fee, $3,500, and pay a monthly $200 retainer. The guys go into gyms and train employees how to teach the class, set them up with all the gear, t-shirts, dog tags, and yes, pink boxing gloves. Two clubs on the East Coast have already signed up, one in Ormond Beach, Florida, and the other in Wilmington, North Carolina. The Wilmington Athletic Club is offering Pink Glove classes 5 times a week. Program director Sarah Goodwin says at least 10 women show up every class.
You take a risk in anything you bring to a club. You know, you don't know if your members are going to adapt to it and like it or not, and a lot of people don't like change. You can make it your own and give the feedback to the people that, you know, started the program or just to make it a better program overall.
Goodwin says her club members pay a little extra to attend Pink Gloves classes, and at a time when their club membership is low, it's a challenge. Back at Smitty's Barn, one of the women in class is testing to earn her pink gloves. See, the program runs on a tier system, so getting your pink gloves is sort of like earning your black belt in karate. The guys say they've invested about $10,000 into their venture. Milodragovich had enough confidence in pink gloves to quit his day job as a civil engineer, and the two are part-time personal trainers to help make ends meet. Still, entrepreneurship goes on.
9 out of 10 businesses fail. Well, this is my 4th one, so if I say I've already failed 3 times, then my odds just keep increasing.
Garrels and Milodragovich will launch their program at a Helena, Montana gym next month and are even talking with a club owner in Sweden. For NPR News, I'm Emily Ritter in Helena.
This next story is about
What's that story about?
Small startup business.
Starting a business in the middle of a recession. One of the ideas was, how hard is it to start up a business in a recession? Let's talk to somebody from the Small Business Administration. This is any meeting of the business desk always starts with, because all of the editors except for me were based in DC, let's find somebody in the government to tell us how hard something is or how easy something is. And I said, I do not want to hear that piece. This is a story about people taking risk. How much money did they invest? $10,000 of their own money. You know, these are not rich, these are recent college graduates who somehow came up with $10,000 of their own money. The numbers in this one are really, really pared down. I mean, $10,000, and then a little earlier you hear that it costs $3,500 for the initial fee and then $200 a month, because I thought that you needed to understand that this wasn't just something they were giving away. It was actually a way of earning income. And you know, I asked her to actually go back and find out that, I said, are they making a living on this? And she had to go back and ask them, like, are you actually able to make ends meet? Oh, no, they have to do some part-time personal training to help make ends meet. But, you know, I just love this. This, again, was one of those stories that started with, let's find some statistics on, you know, small business startups during a recession and tell, you know, how many of them fail, how many of them make it. Well, you know, in the last piece of tape, he gives you the statistic that we knew to be true because we had done our homework, which is actually part of one of the next points I wanted to make, is that, you know, all of these stories involve a lot of information, but it's sort of handed to you very, very gently. Like, 9 out of 10 small businesses fail. It's handed to you in a quote here. But you wouldn't know that to be true unless you did your homework, and you wouldn't want to put that into a story if you hadn't done your if you did your homework and found that in fact, many fewer businesses succeed. If that had been not true and it had been like 50% of the businesses fail, we wouldn't have let him say it
right.
in the story. So, I happen to actually know that 9 out of 10 fail because I had been working on this very large series. And other pieces, which I'm not going to play for you, were about businesses that were in fact closing and downsizing and shrinking. So this was not just a series about happy stories. I just happen to like these two because they're about beer and boxing. I don't really drink beer or care about boxing, but I think that enough people could sort of the hook for this story is like women boxing, and with pink gloves. I just think it's kind of fun and exciting. Other questions or comments on this story? Yes.
I'm not in radio. How do you connect from your meeting to that person in Montana?
I don't know what you mean.
How did that person end up doing your story from your meeting?
Oh, she was one of my... she worked for the... She was a fellow in the Economic Training Project, so I worked with 22 reporters across the country over the last year and a half. And she had never done a business story before and was a little worried about it. She was basically the legislative reporter for the state of Montana. And I think everybody came pretty scared about covering business and economics, and especially she was in my what I called the beginners group, which were people with less than 3 years of experience who had never ever covered economics before. And I basically told them, like, stop worrying and start telling stories, and I will help you, like, find the one or two pieces of information to put into a story. Rather than making it information laden, make it story heavy. With a couple of pieces of information. Other questions?
Yeah,
yes?
I just have one comment. I think in decades past, the listener has been conditioned to expect a certain tone of gravitas in mm-hmm. business reporting, right. and to expect a certain laundry list of numbers and percentages and highs and lows. And I think with this huge leap to visual news and videos and websites, et cetera, we need to have to keep that interest in the listener, a visual, audio mm-hmm. visual, because you can see the bar in the beer store. You
right.
can see the gym in
right.
the boxing story. Whereas, I guess I could see the tree in the tree story, but... It was so obscure.
You can't see the tree for the forest of numbers in that story.
Well played.
Oh,
I actually think that now I'm able to say this more now than ever, and I think that I've been hanging out at some of your websites, and I think that some of them have a long way to go, and some of them are on their way there. And I was really impressed by Homer's use of Facebook yesterday and how they're putting stories online there. There are better places to go if you want to see a chart than the radio. And that place to go should be your website. Your website isn't just sort of this adjunct to what you're doing on the air. It's a place to expand the audience for people who are interested in different sorts of things. Storytelling is a very ancient thing that you sit around, oral storytelling is this ancient thing where you sit around a fire and you tell somebody a great story. And we're still doing that on the radio. But we also have new ways to tell stories, like through, Venn diagrams and charts that move, and through illustrated cartoons. I'm going to talk a little bit about this in a session tomorrow on sort of the Planet Money approach to covering business. It makes it sound like all I do is business, which I don't.
We do a lot of business stories.
Yeah, I mean that's what I. One of the reasons that I was happy to. Yeah, one of the reasons that I was happy to do it is that I hear a lot of business stories when I went to your website. You're all doing business stories, but they're very heavily information laden, and I cannot honestly remember any of them. And I guess the point for me is, there are better places to go to get lists of numbers, and there are better ways to communicate lists of numbers than to read them out loud to people, as the tree story that I read to you illustrates. What we can do with an audio story is, introduce you to an interesting character, present the tension or what is the plot of this story. Plot, character, and setting are the things that I always ask about during pitches, and I'm going to talk about that when I talk about pitching tomorrow. But, I don't really want a pitch that involves a lot of pieces of information. I want a pitch that says, there's this guy doing something really interesting, and this other guy's trying to stop him from doing it, and we're not going to know what happens until this vote happens in 2 weeks. Like, that's up there. You've got characters and plot, and, you know, I'll ask you to get a scene so that we have a sense of setting for the story.
I guess I actually have one question kind of related to that point. You talked about how there are ways to get information. I know that personally in my own community, I'm the only reporter for hundreds of miles.
Right.
There isn't a reporter for the local newspaper, and people do rely on a lot of the numbers and information including on our website. And sometimes, given the resources, you sort of have to choose whether the cover story to include all of that relevant business information versus the story. And I mean, there isn't time every day to produce a supplemental website and a more interesting story for the radio. So I guess I was wondering if you had any insight on how we would tackle that problem.
So are you taking you would take a radio script and like just basically rewrite it for the web? Is that what you're doing?
Yeah, you take your radio script. Your cuts, sort of give it more of a newspaper
play to it.
Right,
right.
But I mean, so I'm covering the
mission
industry.
Mm-hmm.
No one else really
did.
Right.
In my
region.
We're actually
going to
talk about that.
Does
that
make sense? I'm glad you're going to talk about that. I mean, I would say that like every medium cannot accomplish everything. And one of the glories of having, you know, multiple platforms is that, you know, maybe the website is the best way to put up a chart that shows, like, numbers of fish caught. That's not the best way. It's very hard to illustrate that on the radio. And I'm not going to play for you the famous Robert Krulwich thing where he mounted an opera about interest rates, because it's played way too often and it's, like, 30 years old, and I don't think we should be playing 30-year-old best-of pieces because we have evolved a lot since then. I guess I am interested in inviting as many people as possible into listenership, and if you're only writing stories for, you know, somebody on a fishing boat, you're then not writing stories for the. I mean, I don't know what the size of your town is. You're in. Okay, a lot of this advice then just isn't going to work in places. I should have rethought this part of the presentation for Alaska, because I do this in a lot of places where I simply say, like, you know, most people don't know anything about the logging or the timber industry or the fishing industry.
There's a lot of fishing towns. Like,
yeah.
It's one of those things where, you know, you say the total allowable catch is, you know, 1.2 million metric tons. That number matters.
That's the big news, is the story, is
right.
What the catch is.
But could you think of a way to do that where, like, that is the big important news, but then do you have to do a 4-minute story to impart that piece of information to people? Can't you just say the total allowable catch is now 4.1 whatever? I mean, do you need to do 4 minutes on that? I would rather hear 4 minutes that tells me a story and doesn't try to keep telling me the same one sentence over and over again. Support, even if you get 15 people to agree with you in that story.
Right. Now, usually you do, oh, well, this is a major increase, and how is this going to affect, you know, these people and these vessels?
Right.
Why have, like, you talk to the scientists about, you know, why has the number changed? Because it's been, you know, sort of anxiety inducing. But a lot of that still involves a lot of numbers that people do want to hear at some point. And I've had complaints, you know, like, you know, we didn't have the context for how this compares to, say, like,
okay. It sounds like the work that you're doing is much more what would be in an industry trade journal than would be. I guess that's the real difference between when I'm editing a piece and when most local stations are editing pieces. Like, you're basically providing the industry trade journal of the air to people, which is dramatically different than, like, what the audience in Albuquerque. And which is also, I mean, frankly, we had this conversation at dinner last night. Like, sometimes people will pitch me national stories, and I'll talk about this again tomorrow, that you know, I heard, was it your piece about Salmon Row?
No.
Somebody did a piece about Row.
Oh, you're talking
earlier
about,
this week.
Well, there was Melody Kay and Sitka did a story about the price of
yeah.
herring row.
Yeah, a herring, okay. I thought that was an, I, It was one of those like, oh, this is like, is that used for caviar?
It's it's a delicacy in Japan.
Because I heard the story and I thought this would be a great story if we just didn't keep talking about like millions and millions of fish eggs. If we simply said like, there are more fish eggs now and so the price is going to go down, or whatever the point of the story was, and then to actually find somebody who's going to make more or less money based on that. But I understand that I'm trying to edit it for an audience that doesn't know anything or care anything about the fishing industry. What they want to do is know how much their caviar is going to be.
Right. And I guess, so you're going to say, you're talking about how you sort of balance these.
Yeah.
I actually think that's a great point, the trade journal analogy. I think that I'm glad you mentioned that, because that sort of changed the way that I was looking at doing the work this afternoon and tomorrow. So we won't get into any of that right now.
The analogy to me that hit me when I first came up here in terms of fishing is when I grew up in Ohio, I used to get up early on Saturday mornings and watch the farm report. Because I like to see baby pigs and chickens and cows. I lived in a city and I was a kid and I liked farm animals. Mm-hmm. But the farmers were getting up in the morning to watch that. They were just pictures.
Right.
And the information was blah, 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 number, blah, 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 number, blah, blah, blah,
right.
Which meant a lot to those folks. Mm-hmm. Well, we cover, like Petersburg, which is a fishing town, certainly where you are, and quite a few of our towns, there are a hell of a lot of people who they want to get that, and that's where they get it. But I think the point is, I mean, maybe we do have to have more numbers in some of those, but we still probably don't have to have as many numbers, and we could have a little more human interest in there, or even a lot more human interest, just because we still, even in Petersburg, there are people who don't fish. Even in Kodiak,
there are
people.
I mean,
it's true.
Right. Well, the main difference between what an industry journal is writing for is people engaged in the people who want to know more about something they already know a hell of a lot about, versus listening to Morning Edition is people interested in the world who want to know something about something they don't know anything about, or know the vaguest little thing about small businesses and so they want to know more. So I guess that's a tough one. Well, yeah, I guess they want a combination of both, because there are, the science desk at NPR really does get down into the weeds of things. But I'm going to play a science piece for you over lunch that is my favorite science piece ever, that is really about literature.
There's a moose outside.
But it's refreshing to hear you say that you want more pitches that say, like, there's this guy who, et cetera. Because I remember when a memo went around NPR from the arts desk, and it's interesting because since it's the arts desk, I think they were feeling like their stories needed to be more businessy.
Mm-hmm.
And the memo was like, I don't want any more pitches that start, there's this guy
who has a new exhibit.
There's this guy who has a new exhibit. There's a guy with a band. There's like
right.
that. And I remember like talking with an art director. He was like, well, I still like those stories. I don't know what I'm trying to say. Basically, like, the arts desk trying to become more businessy, I think they were like, oh, no, a surfeit of information is what we need.
Right.
As opposed to like the business desk needs to be more, when you're doing
more
business
human,
stories,
right.
you have to like, really push to make sure you're not, hitting people over the head with decimal
right.
points.
Right, right. I mean, I think one of the joys of working with station reporters is that station reporters tend to get to do these pieces that I prefer to hear versus the Jim Zaroli 3.5-minute What Happened on Wall Street Today story, which does have three analysts in it, because he can't, the market closes and 45 minutes later he has a piece on the air, like, there's a 1,000-point drop today, and it dropped 10 minutes before the final bell, and so he has to really slam to get something on the air in 45 minutes, whereas we said the day before, let's do a small business story about a successful small business grant from the stimulus, so let's we had an extra day basically to do that story. I mean it's a little unfair for me to play the pink gloves thing, I think in part because it was we're in you know, Wilmington suddenly, and she had a long time to work on that story, much more time than I think a lot of people in this room have a chance to work on.
We can take away, though, is what you're saying. I mean, we all do those number stories, mm-hmm. but also we also do the stories you're talking about where we follow that with, like, you're allowed to catch 100,000 pounds of halibut this year mm-hmm. in Area 2C, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
The next story we do maybe a week later, it might take us more time, is, mm-hmm. is Joe Blow had to fire his deckhand on his boat because he can't catch enough halibut
right.
this year and he can't pay his mortgage and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's the kind of story I think you're talking about.
Yeah.
And we
yeah.
all do those too. So that's, I mean, we can focus.
I mean,
that.
One thing that I've noticed, there's been a dramatic increase within NPR of doing 3.5-minute stories that should have probably always been 1-minute spots, and now they are just 1-minute spots, and we don't do the 3-minute story about it. I think that sometimes we used to do 3-minute stories on things that should have been 1-minute spots because we didn't have anything else to put on the air, and so if, you know, there's a reason why on the very first All Things Considered there was a 22-minute piece about a protest in downtown Washington, D.C., because they had nothing else to put on the air, and that doesn't mean that it was better, it just means it was longer. And when we talk about pitching tomorrow, I'm going to talk about how the average length for a story that I would bring in is somewhere between 3.5 and 4 minutes, which is not bad compared to the average length being 5 minutes 20 years ago. It's that we didn't have enough stuff to put on 20 years ago, 10 or 20 years ago. Let me play another piece for you. This is one of my favorite pieces. This is a really good writer. And he is in a place just as remote as some places that you live, only he is in a landlocked remote place.
We have another financial venture to tell you about this morning. Native American tribes are major players in the casino business, and one tribe in South Dakota is moving into a different kind of gambling. The Lower Brule Sioux tribe just bought a New York firm called the West Rock Group, creating the first fully Native-owned investment firm. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Charles Michael Ray reports.
So I'm sitting in the Lower Brule Tribal Casino right now. It's pretty quiet. That's because there's really no one gambling here. This casino is in the middle of South Dakota. There's no real large population centers around here to bring in people to gamble. So, rather than relying on this for revenue, the tribe is banking on this. The closing bell on Wall Street sounds a bit like a slot machine. The comparison between gambling and investing is obvious these days, but there's more to this. It turns out that being owned by Native Americans is an advantage on Wall Street. Now that the Westrock Group is a tribal business, it doesn't pay taxes. Westrock brought in $22 million in profits last year. Now it's free of federal income tax. The tribe is keeping on Westrock's CEO Don Hunter. At first, he didn't want to sell the company, but
when someone told me it was a minority business and that it was even a Native American business, it really made a lot more sense.
Hunter says a major advantage of tribal ownership is access to a new pool of money. State pension funds, college endowments, and other government contractors have rules that require part of their money to be invested through minority-owned firms. Hunter says this requirement gives Westrock thousands of potential new clients.
The growth of the company could be exponential compared to what it would have been if we were just doing it on our own.
The Lower Brule Sioux tribe bought this firm to boost its own economy. The tribe is very poor. It's struggling with 40% unemployment. Tribal Chairman Mike Jandrew says this venture on Wall Street will help build education, infrastructure, and jobs.
The constant reliance on the federal government has not been in the best interest of the tribe. And so therefore, what we find ourselves dealing with is the fact that we must find new and innovative ways to take care of ourselves.
But how much money will come back to the tribe and exactly how it will be spent is under wraps. Vicky Hermanyhorses is a tribal resident who is critical of the lack of transparency. She wants to know where Chairman Jandrew got the money to buy this firm and how much he paid, to items the tribal government won't divulge.
If you look at a tribe as a corporation, we're shareholders. Every one of us has a single share in this tribe. He has no more right than we do to know what's going on with our assets, because we're all going to be gone one day and it's going to be our kids who are left standing here and wondering what the heck did they get us into.
The tribe insists that the level of transparency here is the same as it would be for any other business. There is an historic connection between Native Americans and New York's financial district. Wall Street is named after a defensive wall that was built by early Dutch settlers in Manhattan in order to keep Native Americans out. Over 350 years later, the Lower Brule tribe has broken down that wall. Now it has to prove to investors it can succeed. For NPR News, I'm Charles Michael Ray in Rapid City, South Dakota.
New.
What's the story about?
The tribe diversifying into becoming an investment company as opposed to a casino. And some controversy about with their tribal membership or their shareholders.
One of the reasons that I like the story is that it imparts a huge amount of information, but it doesn't do it in a very heavy-handed way. Like the most important information for me in this story was like, oh, that's right, pension funds and college endowments and some government agencies have to invest in minority businesses. So this piece actually started as, let's do a story about minority set-asides. And of course there was going to be, and somebody probably floated the idea of, let's talk to, you know, the person who wrote that piece of legislation. And I said, no, let's actually talk about what that might mean for a real business. And I just love this story because it's sort of like two struggling organizations, a fairly small investment company, and $22 million in profits is very, very small for an investment company, and a really struggling tribe that together can somehow figure out how to work well together. I think it's such a great story. Now, this is also a story where he had terrible tape for this story because everybody was a terrible talker. So we had to come up with the whole conceit of the bell and the machine and the slot machine at the beginning, because the two people from the tribe were just really, well, actually the woman from the tribe was much better than the head of the tribe, who was, I think he talked to him for like 2 hours, and I listened to most of those 2 hours to try to help find the one piece of tape that made sense. And then the investment guy, you know, we ended up using a really nice piece of tape from him, but there were some other real doozies in there where he was talking about, you know, the point at which he actually brought out a calculator during the interview and was showing how the taxes would work on $22 million different. And I thought, I don't want to hear a calculator on Morning Edition. Like, and I also think that, it, you know, that may have been the go-to default scene in that story of the calculator, but, you know, since this was about gambling, and I said, how far away is that casino? He said, oh, it's only a 20-minute drive from where I live. Oh, go there and do a stand-up at the beginning of your story.
Did he use stocks? Sound of the Wall Street Bell?
Yeah, I think he got that off YouTube or something. That's just the closing bell.
Is that why he used so-and-so said instead of because the interviews were so bad? Because they find that, you know, it's much better to have them say what they're trying to say.
You'll notice at one point where he has to start a sentence, he starts their sentence and they finish the sentence because the person just couldn't get a whole sentence out.
But I think it's still effective, so it's interesting that you want to always stay away from that, but he still made it work.
If the story is interesting enough to force the tape to work, you can do many, many things. I mean, Robert Kolich is sort of a master of that, like, not particularly good interview, but if you edit the hell out of it, you can make it work in radio.
That's the extreme.
Yes.
The fact, like, two words here and two words there.
Well, I mean, he does that extreme sort of two words here, two words there. Other questions about that? I know we have, like, 5 minutes left in this session, and I want to make sure that you have time for a break, because I hate sitting through sessions when there aren't breaks. So, yes?
One thing, I have kind of a dispute with someone at my station about writing out numbers, mm-hmm. and I was just wondering...
What do you mean, writing out numbers?
At $325,000, you know, do you do $325,000, or are you spelling out T-H-R-E-E-H-U-N-D-R-E-D?
In your scripts?
Yeah. Well, especially in copy, like for underwriting,
I would say, whatever works for you to read on the air, and if you need to write it with a dollar sign and somebody else needs to write it out in words, do whatever works for you to not screw up on the air. I mean, I actually tell people, I mean, you'll notice this a lot. You should see our scripts for, like, the foreign desk sends scripts. Everything is phonetic, and so the web people get really bent out of shape when they get, like, phonetic names of people who are real people who actually have names that are spelled certain ways. But, you know, you know, we have 32 million listeners, and we don't want it to be pronounced five different ways when those listeners are listening. So I would say just work whatever way works for you. But you need to standardize. If you're going to put that online, then it needs to be standardized, and I would just say use AP style there. But
I think I asked about this yesterday, mm-hmm. concerning writing of budgets and stuff, mm-hmm. and not so much on the national level, but on the local level, maybe mm-hmm. possibly regional level, I guess, mm-hmm. since my radio station I'm at now deals with an entire region with the Princeton Sound, the Copper River Valley.
Right.
You know, I have to write a regional style as well, but like in terms of shortfalls and stuff like mm-hmm. this, I had a story with the Valdez City School District. They just passed their budget for the year. They had like a $943,000 shortfall they need to make up. So I was just wondering, how do you write that? How do you write how they like have budget shortfall and how they make up that shortfall?
I mean, so the number is they had a $900,000
shortfall, and they had to do this. I mean, there were a lot of numbers, trust me.
But what were the four? They had to do four things to fill the hole?
They had to do a lot of stuff. I wouldn't say just four. I mean, they had to, like, cut two full-time positions, cut another paraprofessional position, spend out of their reserves, ask the city for money. It's just a whole bunch of numbers they have to do to make up this shortfall.
And you're using those numbers, like, you know, $200,000 right. for this, $400,000
right.
for
that. Right. Do you just add all that up and then just
I would not get into the weeds of, you know, I would say I would come up with the big number, the $900,000, and then I would try to, like, how does this affect you who has a child in school? So that $900,000 means that they're going to cut, among other things, and this is one of those, you know, great, yeah. Among other things, they're going to cut two teachers. Well, that means larger class sizes. And so I like, immediately as the editor, I'm like, you need to get into one of these classes that's going to be larger. You know, there are already 30 kids in the class. It's going to go up to 40 kids in the class. Like that, I always want to know what the follow-on effect of this is, because people don't understand $900,000, but they do understand that their kid is in a classroom that has too many kids in it.
So you're looking for the follow-on effect.
How would the real person at the end of that chain be affected by this? And then you can, you know, someplace you can say, you know, there's been a $900,000 shortfall in the city budget. Most of that's going to come out of out of education. Among the many effects, it's going to mean larger class sizes. I've told you one number in that. And then the story can begin with, you know, Jill Smith has a class of 30 kids right now in second grade. Next year, she's going to have a class of 40 kids. And then you can sort of take us into the classroom and hear what it's like to have 30 kids, and you know, sort of illustrate the chaos of 30 kids. And, you know, You could actually use sort of fun sound way. You could like, you know, say, I'm now going to increase the volume of this classroom by 25% and turn it up.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you can actually have some fun with the radio, you know. So that, I mean, I think that could be a way. You know, you could also, you know, take it down to the very micro level. How much time does Jill Smith spend grading math papers now on her own time? Okay, I spent, with 30 kids, I spend 2 hours grading math tests every Friday evening. With 25% more kids, that means I'm going to spend 2.5 hours of my own volunteer time grading these math papers. Like, that's a way to really sort of bring it down to what it's really going to do to a person. Because people will understand that in a way that they're not, like, you cannot imagine or quantify $900,000. So that would be my advice.
Well, the question is, when you're dealing with stories where it's, how is it affecting somebody? And oftentimes, especially in, like, towns, again, like Petersburg or Kodiak, where a lot of times, for instance, you'll talk to, right now, a big issue is charter operators have a size limit on the halibut they're allowed to have their clients keep. And so you can talk about how that impacts their business, and you get that kind of, you know, small, low level, but it'll almost always invariably happen. What they talk about, well, they'll be bitching about the commercial fleet, the larger boats that catch commercial. So how... And that's fine, and then you include the commercial guy, because once they get attacked, then you feel like, you know, you do need to
right.
include, because you've had other stories where it's just the opposite. Mm-hmm. And so you get this back and forth going. How do you see covering that when you basically just want to bring it down to the level of, here's a local charter guy who's lost half his clients because of blah, 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 And he goes on and on about, you know, how, but a big part of what he's saying is, you know, if it hadn't been for the commercial fleet making the IPHC cut our quota, blah, blah, blah,
mm-hmm.
you know, or to the other way around, it's a commercial, but how do you get away from the politics of it, essentially, the allocation issue, and just focus on the human side when you know that that person, what they really want to do is pitch about who they think
is. Well, I don't think you want to get away from the politics, but you want to sort of help people understand that the politics has this actual impact on people's lives.
Right.
I mean, you could do that as two separate stories. You know, today and tomorrow we're going to be looking at the number affects different types of fishers. There's the charter fisher and the commercial fisher, and you know,
we do that.
You could do. I would probably say don't try to put too much stuff in one story.
You think it's better to handle it in one story as opposed to sort of the sort of back and forth.
I mean, you could do it, but like, that sounds like you could do that same piece every year, right? So you have to come up with.
this is
also part of the problem. Like an industry journal does the same piece every year with different numbers in it,
yeah.
And you barely even have to re-report the story. You basically just take numbers out of a chart and stick them into words.
The human level every year. It's the same human level. It's the same
right. So it's the same human level.
Different charter operator, different commercial fisherman, but it is. It's the same effect.
Yeah.
You know. So how would you jazz?
You know, at NPR,
more.
We say things like, we did that story last year, and then we don't do it this year.
I know. But,
well, I always say, well, we did the last presidential election, too.
But in that sort of situation, you could... Because I've covered the same mm-hmm. story, and it is a pain, mm-hmm. because you're talking to the same people. I mean, I could write the story before I even
yeah.
interview anybody.
And, oh, I have...
You know, it's...
Yeah.
But the thing is... Maybe since it's cumulative effects, we could do those stories. They're saying last year,
yeah.
you know,
yeah. I would,
actually
ask the people in the story to talk about how it's different from this year to last year, but get them to do the comparisons, and then like every story in every successive year is them talking about how this is different or better or worse than last year, rather than just you know recapitulating and pretending. That your audience didn't hear that story a year ago.
Or you could make a point of the fact that you do it every year
right.
and say at the top of the story, we do this every year. We did it in 2005 when so-and-so said this. They said,
oh yeah, play old tape of them.
In 2006
yeah.
when suddenly another person said that and it's the exact same thing.
Right.
You know, that's
you could also play old pieces for the person, like if you have a new fisher in town, just like play an old piece for them and just record their reaction to the piece. You know, like
yeah, that's how I feel listening right now.
Yeah. And they might say, you could just run that story again. It's
but you could say, you know, last year, you know, Charlie Charter Operator was complaining about only allowing, you know, one fish versus two that his clients can get. This year it's the sizer. This year, and then you have saying
right.
they can only catch 37-inch long halibut, blah, blah,
right.
blah.
Right.
So it gives you the context. And why didn't I think of that when I did that last story?
I covered religion for a long time, and there's an association of religion reporters who got together and wrote a Mad Lib for how to cover churches that are... I can send it around if you want it. It's a Mad Lib for how to cover churches voting whether or not to ordain gay people. And it was basically, you just sort of... You know how Mad Lib works. And reading it at the end is hysterical.
Unitarians.
Yes, exactly.
Need a denomination.
Right. Well, we don't ask for a denomination. We ask for, like, you know, a cardinal direction and an ordinal number. So, like, you know, fourth north, and then we supply the name of the church. So, well, we're out of time. I have one other thing that I want to say. Here are the questions that you should, and I can send this to you later. I would say like, there are certain questions that you have to ask. And I always think that there are really only about five questions that you have to ask in every story, which is, you know, tell me the story about X, whatever the thing is. What's the best part about that thing? What's the worst part about that thing? What part does your opposition get wrong? I think that's a great question to ask in almost any story. What part does your opposition misunderstand about you? And then, of course, you know, what should I have asked you that I didn't ask you, which is always the best last question. But here are the economics questions that you really can't forget to ask. Now, I don't think you should put all of these in your story, but you need to know them as an informed reporter. And they're going to make you uncomfortable. How much money do you make?
Right.
That's a very hard question, and I realized how hard that question was after I told you I covered religion for a long time. I was quite comfortable asking people questions like, where did the priest touch you? But I was not at all comfortable asking people, how much money do you make? So, I mean, that's the level of taboo around money that we have. You know, how many did you sell? How many did you make? What was your revenue? What were your profits? Don't confuse revenue and profits in your reporting. And you can understand the difference if you read something like Charlie Whelan's Naked Economics. What was your profit margin? How much money did you invest? If somebody's running a business and they can't answer these questions, they don't know what they're doing. They've not written a business plan, because those are the questions that come up in a business plan. And so we actually did some interviews for that small business series where I had the reporters asking these questions and they couldn't answer a single one of them. I said, they're not really running a small business. They're just like, they have a dream. And they haven't actually put any work into the business plan. And most of them would let you see a business plan. If you say, can I see a copy of your business plan? And just read it. Because most of those questions will be answered in that plan, and then you can ask them intelligent questions about the business plan.
Dovetailing on that quickly, when I ask in my marketplace series how much you make and what was your revenue or profit, and they say, oh, it's confidential, we don't want to say, I always go, well, how close can we get to it? Like, how can we quantify it in a way that'll make you and your investors comfortable and yet we'll get our job done?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Sometimes they think you want more specific information than you're asking for, I think.
That's right. Is that like, so, and then you just start throwing more than 10,000? No, not more than 10,000. More than 5,000? And you just keep, you know, and then they'll start laughing because you're getting so close. And then you'll be like, oh, okay, I can put that in the script. And you start writing the script in your head, like so-and-so makes more than 4,000. Okay, yeah, I can put that on the end.
I started insisting on the how much money do you make question, even if it doesn't get into the story, because we did this little thing last fall, I think it was, where we asked people how much money they made, and it was just like a Vox on ATC. How much money do you make, and are you middle class, working class, blue collar, white collar? We asked them to give an amount and to put themselves into a class. And we had a person, Emily got this great tape out of Helena, Montana, where the person said, I make $21,000 a year and I'm solidly middle class. I own a home and it's half paid for. And then we had somebody else in Northern Virginia say, I make $150,000 a year and I'm working poor because I live in a house that costs $2 million and it's a two-bedroom, one-bath house. And I thought, well, that, in fact, person is working poor because all of their income is going to that house. But this other person who lives in a much cheaper place. And so we were, I think that we were tossing around, you know, so-and-so is solidly middle class, which doesn't mean anything, because solidly middle class means something dramatically different in Northern Virginia than it does in Helena, Montana.
How honest do you think people are when asked how much they make?
You know, I have asked people to ask to see their pay stubs. If, you know, if somebody says, I cannot afford to pay my mortgage payment, and we're going to put them on NPR saying, this person cannot afford to pay their mortgage payment. Tamara Keith, one of our business reporters, did a story about this woman who walked away from her mortgage. She basically said, I'm not going to pay anymore. Bank, take it back. I'll just consider the money I already paid in a loss. And I said, you need to see her mortgage, like have her bring out the mortgage, and I need you to look at a pay stub of hers to make sure that, like, she's actually able to afford this mortgage, but she's choosing to walk away from it. That's part of the due diligence of fact-checking.
We need to take a little break here. So Laura can come back.